Welcome to the Media Cat Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Mike Pigger, editor at the magazine. And for today, we have another pod in our series, Rebel with a Cause, hosted by Rankin's Opal Turner. In this one, Opal chats to Lucy Jameson, founder of Uncommon Creative Studio. They talk about Marmite, the importance of media and the lessons of Daniel Pink, and what Lucy might do if she was starting out fresh in the industry today. Just for now, we hope you enjoy, and over to Opal.
Welcome to the Media Cat Magazine podcast. Thank you for tuning in for the next in our series, Rebel with a Cause, with me, Opal Turner. For this series, we're talking about the relationship between creativity and strategy, or in other words, art, science, and logic. It's my pet theory that strategy and planning can be a creative secret weapon, and that we overly separate the disciplines in our industry. So today, we are talking to one of the industry's best, Lucy Jameson, founder of Uncommon Creative Studio, which we all know, but arguably the hottest creative studio in the UK, if not the world. So welcome to the podcast, Lucy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Opal, for having me, and thanks for the lovely intro.
So let's jump right in. I'm always interested in how people came into the industry. And I'm very aware this is in some ways a very cliche question, but I feel like we get different insights into our own lives and our own choices and how we got to be where we are as we grow and age. So I'm intrigued. You studied history at uni. So what drew you to your first job at BNP DDB and this industry?
Part of it was I needed to get a job if I wanted to come into London and hang out with my friends. So that was a big part of it. And I joined the industry in the early 90s. And back then there wasn't that many choices. If you thought, oh, you know what, I want to do something a bit more creative. There was, you know, Law, City, all of that sort of stuff. But it was pre the tech companies. It was pre-internet and entrepreneurship being a thing, which I suspect I might have been drawn to if I was, you know, coming out now. That was one thing. And then being really honest, I went to the Oxford University Career Service and started at the beginning of the alphabet, and advertising is A.
I love that answer. Thank you for your honesty, firstly. I live for it. Secondly, you'll love this. My life partner is also my creative partner. Shout out to all the creative couples. And when we were choosing what he was going to do at university, we literally went through the list from A to Z. And we were like, advertising sounds pretty cool. That's pretty cool. That sounds like you. You can do that. And here we are. So you're not alone. It's still happening. We're going, advertising, that sounds all right. Okay, cool. I love that. It's interesting that you say about being drawn to entrepreneurship if you're coming out now, though, because from my perspective, I see you as a very multidisciplinary person, because you've been an account planner, a strategy director, a CSO, a CEO, and now a founder. So what skills or abilities have you found enabled that kind of ability to shift and evolve through those changing environments and expectations also on what you're doing and who you're expected to be?
Yeah, I mean, they're all quite related, I think. And I guess I sort of felt like, I mean, you know, again, being really honest, I looked at the track record of strategy people who became chief execs, and it was terrible. And I actually called up, a headhunter I really respect and rate. And I just said, do you think I should do this? I'm really worried if I don't do it well, I'll kind of completely trolley my whole career. And he said to me, A, that's really funny because you're a woman, and I would never have a man saying that to me. In all my years, I've never had a man say that to me. And B, said, yes, I think you should do it, partly because you've seen how badly it can be done. And actually, in a way, I think I just applied my really strat sort of, you know, approach and kind of went, who do I think has done this well? I went and interviewed, actually. I called up Scylla, Snowball. I called up Ben Fennell from BBH. I called up lots of chief execs that I admired and thought were doing a good job and said, can I come and have a chat? Because I've never done this. I've been a planner for 20 years. What would your advice be? And what do you think the differences are? So I did sort of, you know, sit there and go, right, okay, what are the things I think I can learn? Which is obviously what I'd normally do in my day job. And then I'd sort of went, what are the things I think I'm bad at, which I'm going to have to grapple with? And probably it is that thing of, you know, actually just picking up the phone first, rather than kind of going, I'm going to think it through and I'm going to be super analytical and go through all the pros and cons and then maybe in 2 days' time pick up the phone, just gritting my teeth and going, right, I'm actually just going to hit the phone on certain things a lot faster than I normally would. That sort of thing of just spending more time talking to people, whether that is, you know, where it was an account I thought might have a problem, or where wasn't a client I didn't know very well, or any of those things, you know, maybe rather than going and do the kind of desk research or whatever I might normally do, is just pick up the phone and call. So I think that's sort of one of the biggest sort of changes, and I think it's just made me a load more proactive generally in what I do, and, you know, less of the sort of academic noodling and more of the getting on with it. Yeah, and I think that equally is like a really critical when you found a business, because you just don't have time for that stuff. And you also have to be, you know, very, very much more all over the numbers than you were when you were either, you know, a strategy person or a chief exec of a 550 person company within a giant holding company. When, you know, there are three of you, we started with three people, and you're thinking, we've got to get some stuff in, otherwise we're not paying ourselves, or we're not paying the rent, or whatever it might be. Then, you know, you really do, you think about it a lot harder. And you also learn to be a bit cheekier in what you ask of people. Yeah.
I love that. Just have a tiny bit more audacity. You know, just a bit more of the men's audacity. No, that's such an interesting answer, actually, that you say about kind of just being inclined to talk to people more and yeah, almost engaging in it in a somewhat emotional way, almost, yeah, going, I feel like I want to do this. What do you think I can do? It's so interesting because a couple of episodes ago, we spoke to Nick Kendall, and he was saying that one of his kind of great experiences of strategy is that you do kind of end up being a bit of a psychologist, a bit of a psychotherapist. A lot of your job is to talk to people and to talk them through things. And so it's interesting that you almost delegated that to the people you were talking to and went, please, yeah, do, yeah, what I do for people, for me. I love, yeah, that. And also just, you know, it never hurts to do research. I'm sorry, but qualitative, yeah, research, underrated in my,
yeah, opinion. Yeah, definitely.
Especially in this age. So I'm interested, how much has your view of those disciplines, especially since becoming a founder at Uncommon, kind of creative and strategy, and in my head that kind of goes all the way out to art and science, and by that I mean data and photography and all of the other craft skills. How do you think your view of those disciplines has kind of changed as you've experienced this variety of roles and wild changes in the industry? And as you've grown and aged, do you think you have a different view of how the disciplines work than you used to?
I think I have a much healthier respect for everybody else's role than I did when I started. I suspect I was a bit arrogant. But the more time you spend, you know, with people, you realise just what they bring to the table. And again, you know, on any good day, I think what's made Uncommon successful is that Nils, Natalie and I can kind of do a bit of each other's jobs. And so we also appreciate how hard each other's jobs are. So I think that is, you know, really, really powerful. And when you sit round a table all the time, you just see every bit of it. So it's different from when you interact on the kind of moments where you would normally interact. You're overhearing all the other stuff that you wouldn't necessarily normally see in the process. So I think you get a much, much bigger appreciation of that. And I can see, you know, much more the role of craft, which is probably not something I was nearly as exposed to. When you're a traditional planner, you kind of hand things over a bit when they kind of get to production-y stage. I still do that because, you know, what can I add in that stage? But I understand it better than I used to. I think I understand finances and how to arrange people and all of that kind of stuff a lot better because you have to. And I think, you know, certainly there's those specific relationships. I mean, Nils and I have worked together since 2012. And so that's a decade. So you get pretty good at knowing what somebody's going to think about something, what they're going to find useful, what might open up a subject for them, all of those sort of things. And that kind of, you know, we come from different backgrounds and approach problems in very different ways because, you know, that's just our brains are different. But we know where the really helpful intersection is, where the crossover bit where I know that I can add something in and that will be useful or whatever it might be. So I think that is really valuable, actually. Just the sheer time you spend with somebody else can be really invaluable to getting to stuff quick, which is one of the things that I think sets us apart as well.
And it's from my perspective, I mean, I started my career at the Garage Soho, so we worked with startups. And so, you know, my understanding of being a founder has always been this super multidisciplinary thing. You have to understand everything from pitch decks to VC funding. To finances, to building a team, and you've got to get pretty good at everything, which is why I find it so interesting, your journey and what you guys have done at Uncommon. And you've kept the role of founder, and I get the feeling, and I might be way off the wall here, so you tell me if I'm wrong, but I feel like you've kept that for a reason. You haven't changed it to strategy partner, you haven't changed it to CESO. Was that intentional? And if so, what was your thinking?
Yeah, I mean, it was intentional because I think all of us think it requires a different skill set to found a business. And I think also it commands a different kind of relationship and opens up a different conversation with other founders, with people beyond the marketing department. And that has, again, been one of our big successes, is that we work with a lot of founders where we're working with CEOs as much as CMOs. When we work with big institutional clients, we like to have relationships well beyond the marketing department because we want to be able to have ideas that help transform the whole business rather than just some colouring in and advertising. And I think founder is helpful in that it takes you out of just being advertising and just being colouring in into, yes, I understand what it takes to start and run a business. And so that was very deliberate, yeah.
I love it. Fully agree. It's that common ground, isn't it, that you come to with this understanding that you both have a set of skills that are a broad set of skills. I'm not just one thing. Let's have a conversation that doesn't have to be kind of reined in by our preconceptions of what titles mean. In a weird way, it's actually why I like the title creative, because in some ways, at least outside the advertising community, people are like, that's the most broad, vague thing you could ever describe as your job title. Yeah.
But that was, honestly, that was one of the things that's always bugged me about the industry, is that we have all these brilliant, brilliant creative people. And yet the canvas that mostly advertising agencies ask them to operate in is, you know, here it is, do a 30-second ad or whatever. Actually, that creativity about, you know, how do we recruit people? How do we motivate? How can we do a completely different kind of promotional deal rather than a really boring bog-off or a 30% deal? Or how do we change the whole environment of a store or whatever it is? When you unleash that creativity, it can kind of just, you know, it can impact on so many different things. And again, that was, you know, that frustration was one of the reasons we set up Uncommon, was we wanted to be able to actually do more of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very clear that you've intentionally structured things in a way that allow you to, as you say, talk with businesses across departments and across disciplines. And I've heard you talk before about that you find it a bit crazy that some agencies still have these very separate departments on separate floors. And you quoted MT Rainey, and we play rugby, not relay, which I love. I'm stealing it. I'm sorry. Can you tell our listeners more about how you structure, or rather don't structure, your departments, and how it works when you get a briefing at Uncommon?
I mean, it's very informal. We still have people with the titles of strategy or creative in the agency. But we don't sit together. We don't, I mean, anyone sits wherever they like. That's the sort of, and frankly, works from wherever they like and however they like, because our view is we're very good people and they're highly motivated. And frankly, you just let them get on with it. That is the kind of plan, is you really do that. And I think what is different is there isn't a brief comes in from a client, goes into a system, then goes to planning, then gets signed off, then goes to creative. Right from the beginning, we'll be discussing with a client. And frankly, we rarely wait for a brief from a client. We're almost always writing what we think that brief should be for ourselves, proactively, because that's actually how it usually works. And then sometimes we'll kind of go, can you actually formalize that? Can you check it? Is that actually what we're looking after? And then that is very much the start of a conversation between the team. And we would also bring production quite early on into that as well, because we quite often find production strategy is quite an important part of it, particularly if you're going to be making, I don't know, something, anything from a hairdryer shaped like Piers Morgan's head, or a scent that smells like a baby, or a 24-hour suit hire. Actually, if you're not looking at it's going to be one of these traditional media, you actually need to get production people involved much, much earlier. So we tend to have those kind of conversations in the round, and everybody gets an input at that point. So it's a real sort of conversation rather than here's a brief and here's how it works. Yes, planner will be digging around in, more data, more research, more of that kind of stuff, trying to figure out where that friction is, what's the problem in culture or society that that brand can help fix. So they'll be doing more of that sort of side of it, but it's very much a conversation.
And it sounds like I've always thought this, kind of looking in from the outside, that part of the kind of secret sauce of Uncommon's brilliance is how strong your ethos is internally, how strong your own brand is as an employer, as a company. And to your point, let people just do what they're good at. Sounds obvious, but it's surprisingly not that common. So I wonder, how intentional were you about that internal brand when you started? Because I know you all had, some gardening leave, so you had that time to really think about it, and you've always had this really clear ethos. How much did you think about how to apply that ethos internally when you started?
Quite a lot, actually. I mean, I think for two reasons. One, we've always had that belief that culture eats strategy for breakfast, and your culture is, absolutely critical to kind of, whether you create a great company or not. And that everybody needs to understand and be on board with what that culture is. So that old, I think it's Bezos actually, who said, culture's what people say about you when you're not in the room. And that is the point. You need everybody to know exactly what the core values are, and then they can apply those in their own different way. But if they don't know what those are, then that's a bit of a problem. So for us, that was really, really important, because we'd always believed it. And then I think we're really clear that creative businesses are only ever as good as the people they attract. You know, that is our job, is to get the very best creative talent. And by that, I mean, not just creatives, but creative talent, because then we're going to come up with brilliant, brilliant stuff. Then we're going to have better work. More clients are going to work. It's a virtuous circle. So our job had to be to find ways to kind of unleash that. And we did definitely, we started with our uncontract, which we wrote a little uncontract, which was partly based out of obviously having had to sign horrific contracts and then had issues, which meant we couldn't work for a year. But also it was about trying to sort of figure out, was there a better way of working? Look, if I'm honest, I don't think we've always done our very best at that. I think it's been a roller coaster over the last sort of 5 years. We'd set out with some sort of ideas about, oh, we're going to do Fridays just for us. And of course, that actually doesn't work in practice. But what we have tried to always do is allow people the space and time to fit stuff around their own lives and run their own projects. And if there's a great other thing they're backing or working on, to help try and help them back it, make it happen. And I think that's always been, you know, one of those things. So, you know, we're really excited when things happen, like we get to do a feature film with Nick Cave, or, you know, one of our teams has got an idea and we'll put some money behind it and try and get it up and running. Even it's not a project for clients, it's a project for them and us. Or, you know, or actually they want to go and mentor a startup, or those kind of things. We want Uncommon to be a place where that is all really positive and accepted, and just makes it better, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. Because then you start cross-pollinating those skills, those experiences. And I've always thought, I mean, I know you've been very intentional about calling it Creative Studio and not a creative agency, but it's also in my head looking forward to what the business, our industry will be. I mean, let's be honest, how many of us are looking at entertainment and various different areas of creativity that were not traditionally considered advertising, and doing a feature film with Nick Cave is a great experience to have to call exactly. on.
Yeah, I mean, I was always super inspired by people like Thomas Heatherwick, who's obviously multidisciplinary designer, but has done architecture projects, did the cauldron at the Olympics, has done the bendy the buses and that bendy curl up bridge in Paddington, all kinds of stuff like that. I've always personally been a bit obsessed by architecture, so one day I'd love us to have an architecture practice. You know, that would be amazing. I like the idea that can apply across the board. And I think we look at other businesses and other people, whether it's Ryan Reynolds in the States or whoever, and you go, yeah, they're not kind of going, we sit in our lane and we just do this, so why should we? So yeah, we were always really keen to call it something other than agency, because we didn't want to foster that client dependency, that we will only do things when we're dependent on a client. And I think we learned that at Grey when we did Volvo Life Paint. And that was a lovely project, Volvo. It was about safety. And instead of doing an ad, we made a can of spray paint that was for cyclists, that you could spray on, was invisible, but lit up in car headlights. That was an immensely problematic, in terms of it took us nearly 2 years to get it off the ground, to get the clients to buy into it, to actually, you know, get to a point where WPP would accept the fact that we weren't being paid by a time. We were being paid by a pound on each can that was sold. There were so many issues with it. And we were like, oh, surely that should just be something we can go off and do. And that's a brilliant thing. And it'll make money in a different way, but it'll still make money. And isn't that a good thing? In traditional holding company land, not particularly. But, you know, that was sort of one of the things why we were like, yeah, we shouldn't always have to be dependent on clients. If we see something that is a brilliant idea, we should try and find a way to back it. It's really hard, don't get me don't get me started, is really hard to do. And, you know, sometimes we've totally messed up on that kind of thing. But that was the principle we always had, that we shouldn't be dependent on clients, because that robs creative people of their spirit and their independence, which is so critical to them being creative.
Yeah, and that is true regardless of what part you play in that project. You do not have to have the title of creative to need that respect, essentially, that respect for what you do and your opinion. Because I always say, like, we're selling what is inside our heads. So if someone's not listening to you, they're kind of insulting the reason that you're there. So I very much get that. And in the end, it turned into such a impactful, you know, effective piece of work.
Yeah, you've got to back yourself, I think. It's one of the biggest things that I think agencies have because of the way they run generally, they've stopped having much confidence in themselves. The confidence to turn down clients, the confidence to fund projects themselves, and the confidence that actually breeds, because every time we've turned down a client, new people in the agency look around and go, did they just really? They pulled out of that? Are you kidding me? And it is just like, everyone's like, oh, actually, they mean what they say. And that is really valuable, because it then does kind of just create a different atmosphere.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're defined as much by what you don't do as what you do do. It's really interesting. It kind of almost goes back to that point that you made about that you don't normally get briefs from clients. You are proactively writing them. And that, in my head, maybe it's because I'm, you know, fairly young in the industry, etc., almost makes complete sense. Shocking. Because that's our skill set, is we go, these are the parts of culture you need to get engaged in. This is where your brand is relevant. This is an attention point. This is where you can make the world better.
Yeah.
Why don't we do that? And then people actually care.
Yeah.
Which is always helpful. So it really does kind of all link up together. And I absolutely, you know, so much respect for your guys' ethos, because you do the ultimate thing that 99% of agencies will not do, which is turn down work. And I have to say, I think that's the most important thing you can do. And I wonder, how much do you think that the way that you've structured things and looking out from your experience and your guys' experience at Uncommon, and looking at what's happening in the rest of the industry, your incredible successes, obviously working how you do, how much do you feel, kind of on a broader level, the separation and or connection, depending on how you look at it, between creativity and strategy has kind of influenced what our industry's work is doing and how impactful it is?
Yeah. I think it absolutely does, because if you're going to be able to convincingly say to clients, you know what, we've got an idea here that we think you should be doing, and this is, you know, something much more fundamental to your business, or it operates over here, or it has a bigger commercial impact because it's actually structuring, you know, like an offer or a da, 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 da. I think you need stronger, more business savvy strategy people to help you sell in those kind of ideas. Where honestly, I think if you're just kind of doing a yard of advertising, I don't think you necessarily need that kind of level of skill. Sorry, that sounds awful. I do think very often that we've been sort of put into a position where we're selling a yard of advertising services rather than selling, you know, where is the very best point you can put your creativity, and then here's what we do with it. And I do think that comes from having a much better understanding of how a business works, one of your clients' businesses works overall, having a better appreciation for what are some of the tough choices they're going to be making about where they spend their money, having a better, just a broader understanding of that kind of canvas and the wiggle room you've got to play in. And I think that is where great strategy people really can help enormously. I think a lot of creatives intuitively get there, but actually justifying a business case or managing to frame it in ways that a CFO might buy, or, you know, X, Y, Z, I think that is really important. So I do think that makes a big difference. And I think some of the media arguments are really important there. So we find we struggle a lot with very traditional media agencies. But actually, we love working with some of the more independents, people like Kraft or Good Stuff or people like that, who will not just crank out a kind of media plan, you know, based on, oh, it's got to be, you know, best practices, it's got to be 20 seconds because that's the most efficient and da da da. But actually, again, we'll be looking at how can we make the most creative impacts. How can we justify why that is, we think that's going to work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you could do a whole nother podcast on the separation of media agencies. I'm not going to go into that now, but you absolutely could, because they need to be creative too. It's almost like the context in which you put something is actually relevant.
Yeah,
to
right. Surely not.
How dare I? Honestly. So that's kind of the current state of affairs, if you will. But looking to the future, I know, you know, we've been talking a lot about entrepreneurism, so this won't come as a surprise for anyone, but you've recently launched Unrest, so a purpose-driven accelerator for startups to really change the world. And I'd just love to hear what your thoughts about what role creativity will play in creating that world, and how you approached setting up Unrest and working with them.
Well, I mean, so this actually started, both Natalie and I in our year out spent time working with accelerators. So I went and mentored startups, so did she, and we both worked in different ones. And our biggest observation was that there were a load of founders who came out of the finance space or the technical product space, and very, very few who came out of marketing or brand or creative. So very few of them really appreciated that one of the biggest differences you can make is if you build a brand, not just a product, and that actually the story that you can create is brilliant for not just selling to customers, but selling to retailers, pitch decks, all the rest of it. Having an understanding of that narrative and that whole brand story and the value of brand, because we know that most businesses, it's one of the biggest intangibles is brand value, but it's enormous. So for us, that was just crazy. And we sort of always thought that actually there had to be a much bigger role for brand in startups. Because all the best kind of, you know, startups that have gone ballistic have had really great brands and really great narratives. So that was our kind of first observation. And obviously we were interested in not just doing startups that that would make the world worse. We wanted to do, you know, things that we felt would net have a positive impact on the world. So that was the second piece of the equation. And then the third piece of the equation was we'd spent quite a lot of time over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years trying to find and cook up individual relationships with brands where we either did collaborations or sweat equity or were right in at the beginning. And, you know, from Halo Coffee, which was the thing Nils launched right at the beginning, which was a, you know, fully compostable version of Nespresso capsules. I think we learned that you need to have real sector expertise and work with founders who've got that, because we don't necessarily have that and we don't necessarily want to get into that. I did not get into the business because I want to do logistics of a coffee company. That is definitely not my skill set. And then you know, I think we'd found that, that it was just random serendipity where it did come together, but it was a long, slow process. We put together loads of ideas that, you know, we got really far down the line and then for whatever reason fell apart. And we wanted to try and find a better way of identifying startups that we could help and could work with. So that was really the thinking behind it. And obviously they've run one beta cohort and one sort of tiny mini cohort. And I think, you know, you can see as not only has it been really fun for our people to work on, so like our strategists went and mentored some of them, and I think it made them reflect on, you know, again, much wider issues, learn about how a startup works, think through what they really think forces, you know, as soon as you have to teach something yourself, you really do kind of know what you've learned. So it's sort of really valuable. And also you can just, it's really lovely to start seeing, you know, some entrepreneurial people are just amazing and that they have loads and loads and loads of ideas. But it's a bit like that old Michelangelo quote, you know, the statue is already in the block of marble. I just need to chip stuff away. And quite often with entrepreneurs, I think that is the case. Some of them are so pinging with ideas. You just got to go, no. What's the focus? Which is the real one? What's the gem that we're going to shine the light on that's going to be core to your story? All of this other stuff is lovely, but we're going to create a Christmas tree where there's one thing that you can hang all the rest of it off rather than just trying to ping all of it down and do it all at once. So I think a lot of it has been about that, really. So who knows where it will go, but, you know, I think we've just been keen to experiment over the last 5 years with lots of different ways of trying to put our creativity to bear. And that one's the sort of the latest attempt.
But why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you try all of these different things? And I'm sure that is what, you know, most of your clients love about you, is that you don't stick in these boxes. You don't exist in this one realm. And I mean, even from what you're saying, working with Unrest, your entire team is getting this experience of becoming multidisciplinary, is getting this wider understanding of businesses and entrepreneurs and how things work outside of, you know, one realm, which, you know, will only help and grow everyone, imagine, or I'd like to believe. So how do you, other than mentoring, which is so key, because as you say, entrepreneurs are generally incredibly creative people, but sometimes just do not know where to start. I'd love to know how you kind of go about, is there like a strict process, or is it very conversational about how you use your creative and strategy skills from Uncommon to build and teach the entrepreneurs in Unrest?
No, I mean, it was one of the things I did again in my year off, was really formulate my idea about what, you know, how you could usefully best, sharpest define a brand. And so we do have a kind of almost what we call an operating system. We do have, you know, here are the five things we think you really need to nail in order to create an Uncommon brand. And at the heart of them is really, what problem do you fix for whom? And how do you do that differently than anyone else? And one of my old clients from ITV was at Channel 4 before. And he said that the very best of Channel 4's programming was programs that operated on a fault line in culture, because they were the things that everyone would then discuss and talk about and would therefore travel. And, you know, everyone would ultimately go and watch them. And I think that is exactly true of the very best brands. They operate in a fault line in culture. They have spotted something where something is changing, or where there's a disconnect, or where what people want to do versus what they should do don't quite add up, or, you know, all of those sort of things. So where there is a fault line of some sort, that's a really, really powerful place for a brand to play. And so we do have a kind of, you know, a little what we call an operating system, the questions, some of the exercises that you would go through in order to identify those things. And we've done that with clients with some of our, you know, design projects, because we also do design only type projects. So we've done that with small startups, and you can see them almost going, ah, right, now I've got a framework where I can kind of go away. You've helped me talk it through. Here's, you know, what you've recommended. But you can also see next time they know that when they come to another brand, they'd almost pick that back up again and start thinking about those are the questions I need to be asking myself. And that would help me define the brand.
Absolutely. I was going to say, they always know the answer already because it's inside them, because so many entrepreneurs, you know, create businesses out of some kind of personal issue, some kind of personal tension, something that they wish existed. And so it's always there. You just need to condense it and communicate it to others, which is a hugely important skill in life and in advertising, but definitely even more so in startups when you're asking people to pay for it. So that's always helpful. But I also think that's really interesting. It goes to the point of being purpose-driven as well, that fault in culture line, because you're being unafraid to go, this is something that we have a point of view on, and you can agree or disagree with it, but either way, you're going to talk
absolutely
about it.
I think I probably was really lucky in that I worked on Marmite as one of my brands when I very first worked at DDB, and you know, quite famously, I was the planner on it, but Rich and Andy, the creatives, one of them loved it, one of them hated it. And that's where the Love or Hate It campaign came from. And that a kind of appreciation of actually how a kind of tension, how powerful it can be, I think was just kind of something I was exposed to very early on in my career. And so it's sort of something that's stuck with me ever since, really. That can just be immensely powerful and fun, not frightening. I think a lot of clients think, oh, it's got to be frightening. But actually, I think people like that. They can kind of pick a side and go for it. And everyone likes that certainty.
I mean, people aren't, you know, kind of the point of the whole podcast, people aren't one thing. So they have, but they have specific views, and brands, you know, as we always say, need to operate like our friends. So if they don't have a point of view, then you're just not going to ever be that deeply engaged. I'm interested, when you are teaching, so I don't know whether it's the CMOs, whether it's the CEOs, and you've gone through these initial kind of five most important things, and you start to get into comms, how do you approach that? Is it always firmly from that business perspective of what are we trying to achieve? Or is it more often from that cultural perspective of what part can we play, or is it
where they meet in the middle? Where they meet in the middle, it's always that intersection. What are we trying to do, and what role, you know, what role are we going to play in culture in order to achieve that? It's absolutely about that intersection and the interplay between the two. And I think, you know, what's interesting is I was thinking, looking back over our pitches, we very often start with almost a letter from a CEO to a new joiner or something like that. And actually them sort of saying, "What, you know, so please, this is what we're all about. This is what you're going to be doing." Because it's such a great way of kind of going, this is what this company is about. And distilling it in that kind of a way, as opposed to, you know, this is a press ad that we're going to start with. Not least because, you know, most companies, a bit like us, their people want to know what they're about too. So it is very often the way we'll start a discussion on a brand platform or something like that.
It's as much about as building that ethos and building that employer brand almost from the inside, and then you just act on it, don't you? It sounds overly simplified.
You're defining what it's about, and you know, we all know. I think, you know, Daniel Pink's done all that incredible work on mastery, autonomy, and purpose are the three things that people want from a job. Yes, money's in there, but it's, you know, it's secondary actually to those three things.
And especially when you're starting a business and you want that business to be something that makes the world a better place, why would you not start with the people that work there? I mean, it's so obvious and yet so overlooked often, I think, as a part of brand and a part of how important purpose is, because, you know, there's lots of these conversations in the industry about
and la 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 la. Yeah.
But at the actual crux of it, when it comes to internally, there's no real argument in my mind about you have to have one that has your people at the front and center, and you have to have a point of view on how that works. Otherwise, what the fuck are you doing?
Absolutely. And it does all come to that, you know, the very oft quoted thing about the, you know, the cleaner at NASA being asked what his job was, and his job was to send a man to the moon. He's the cleaner, but he's still kind of, you know, you want to feel like you're part of something big. We all want to feel like that. No one wants to feel they're, you know, just doing something drudgy.
And so, tricky question, because it's not that long since you started Uncommon, but I'm intrigued. From your first 5 years of learnings, if you were going to start another studio, anything you would do differently, or would you do the whole thing again?
We'd never do the whole thing again because it would be boring. But my honest answer is I probably wouldn't start again. I'd do something different, you know, really quite different.
Architecture firm, perhaps.
Well, right, exactly. I'd be bored if I did the same thing again. And I'm not saying we've got the perfect thing, so I don't think there's things we would have done differently. Of course there are. But I always find that a bit weird, really, where you want to go and do the same thing again. You know, yes, I'm the person who spent nearly 20 years in my first job. But having said that, I felt like I did loads and loads of different jobs within that. And the idea of just going and setting up another studio again doesn't really make sense to me. I feel like I'd want to do something different.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's that inherent value that you have of different experiences and different skills.
Yeah.
So that leads me to my final question. What do you think about my theory that creatives need strategy and can make better use of it? Do you agree? Feel free to disagree.
No, I've always thought the very best creatives were better strategists than I am. Absolutely. I have no doubt of that in my mind at all. And, you know, the ones who get that, they're the ones who go really fast because they get what's at the core of their idea, and they're not just fussed about the execution. They're actually fussed about what's the problem they're trying to solve and why does this idea solve it better than anything else. And at the end of the day, that's what strategy is about. So, yeah, I firmly agree. And I think certainly we've had a lot of very strategic creatives at Uncommon, honestly, who on a, you know, on my best day, I'm not nearly as good as most of them. So it's one of those things where, yes, I know some good questions to open things up and I know how to do that, but I'm not arrogant to assume that actually the best creatives are really great strategists.
I simply cannot add anything more to that. So it's rare for me to shut up, but I'm gonna. So thank you so much, Lucy, for coming on the podcast. That was such a lovely discussion. I thank you so much for taking the time.
No, it's a real pleasure. I enjoyed it.